Chapter 81. Hitler, born at Versailles. Who in Germany of 1919 would have thought of Hitler? Out of 60 million Germans, there could not have been 1,000 who knew his name. Not even 20 Frenchmen, not 10 Americans or Englishmen. Born in Austria, he was not a German citizen. He had fought with valor at the front. He was awarded the Iron Cross, first and second class, for his courage. But who among the military officers commanding him would have seen something other than a brave soldier? In November 1918, the doctors at the Pazewalk Hospital feared he would be permanently handicapped. He had been severely blinded by British poison gas in Flanders a month before. All he owned was a worn uniform and an old pair of shoes. He was the unknown soldier. Never involved in politics, he had been an extremely individualistic young man. An orphan in Vienna, he had often had to find shelter in city refuges. He was an artist and his drawings were quite good. After the war, he was alleged to have been a house painter or a cheap artist of postcards and matchboxes. As a literally starving artist, he may have taken up such work to keep body and soul together, but more than 700 drawings and paintings dating from his early life have since been found, which means he must have created thousands of pieces of art. Much of his work is remarkable. The drawn lines are firm and graceful. A number of his most important paintings are somewhat academic, in the style of 19th-century landscape artists. Some of his other works have been conceived with great daring in inspiration with the contrast and combined harmony of the colors. His portraits are sometimes striking, particularly his Napoleon, which is as firm and inspired as a David. There is also a light-hearted sketch of himself as a soldier with a short mustache. His sketches were swift and to the point. In seconds he captured the essence of a situation. His architectural plans were extraordinary in their power and clarity. The whole history of Hitler the artist has to be rewritten, if only for the sake of art. The same goes for Hitler the poet. His first poems, his hundreds of drawings and paintings, were not involved with politics. In all his works there was not a single political caricature, not even of Franz Joseph, whom he did not like and could have easily drawn. Even after the war, Hitler ignored such obvious candidates for caricature as Ebert and Scheidemann. His work was full of portraits, sketches and humorous caricatures, but they were of friends, fellow soldiers at the front or himself. In Vienna he had intently followed parliamentary debates on occasion, but was far more likely to be found watching performances of Wagner's operas. Music was, even more than art, his passion. He lived for music and drew strength from it. Although he never gave any indication of wanting to get involved in politics, while serving at the front it was known later that politics were secretly on his mind. The tragedy of the post-war era would project him into the political arena. The inequity of the Versailles Peace Treaty created the exceptional circumstances that paved Hitler's road to power. All the obstacles that would have stood in his way were swept away by the treaty. Hitler, as a political man, was born at Versailles. He discovered politics by trial and error. First he lectured, on the order of his military superiors, to groups of returned servicemen. Then he addressed little political gatherings with a handful of participants. Within a few months he realized, as did others, that he possessed an extraordinary gift of persuasion. His raucous voice moved people to the deepest depth of their subconscious. He emanated the power which distinguished a leader of men from all others. Throughout Germany's distress, he had made contact with people's true feelings. He had concentrated the great national and social issues within himself. Alone and against all odds, Hitler's extraordinary inner force and willpower would lead Germany out of bondage and misery. Within months his audiences were convinced that patriotism could not exist without socialism nor socialism without patriotism. The conventional politicians kept mouthing the same old, tired, meaningless party lines and slogans. They were trapped in them. People felt also trapped in the endless and doleful platitudes. Hitler's ideas and eloquence was striking by comparison. They had the galvanizing effect of breathing life and hope to the victims, to the helpless. Every word reached home. Gone were the political lies and disinformation. He spoke of real concerns and matters of substance in words that everybody understood and felt deeply. He spoke with flawless logic and biting irony and released all the legitimate anger, all the energy that Weimar politicians had made it their business to suppress. The public responded generously to this unknown orator who spoke to them so personally. Whether bourgeois or proletarian, his audiences felt Hitler was addressing them individually as full persons, not in the contemptible way politicians treat people as a mindless flock of sheep. Hitler used no props or political tricks to impress the gallery as he went on addressing meetings wearing the same old raincoat. In a country not indifferent to pomp and circumstance, Hitler held his audiences spellbound by the sole power of his word. Many of his enemies have said his oratory swayed and conquered the masses as if he had dispensed bombastic rhetoric, but they did not realize that people found themselves in what Hitler was saying, the unique discovery that they mattered, that someone of charismatic power was speaking what they always felt and thought. It had never happened, and it was an exhilarating experience. People responded to Hitler's inner strength. He was not anybody's man, he owed favors to no one, the speeches he uttered were his. He took responsibility for his words and his actions. In an era of interchangeable, faceless politicians, frightened front men and alien agents, Hitler's mere presence shone out like a beacon. By the year 1923, Hitler was still feeling his way, but at increasingly well-attended meetings. This was the year of the putsch. From Skidmore to Kapp and Luttwitz, the notion of forcing events was widely accepted. Hitler, like others, made the political mistake of risking everything in a premature uprising. He learned his lesson. When he got out of Landsberg prison, he no longer was in a hurry to start another confrontation. He understood there could be no fruitful action without an impeccable organization. He also realized that stable power could only be acquired through legality, resting fundamentally on the will of the majority. It would only be at the end of 10 years of almost superhuman work and 25,000 meetings and gatherings that he would reach, as he had planned, the Chancery, after conquering the Reichstag in the most democratic way. He had been subjected to every opposition and obstruction by the establishment forces, the press, the bureaucrats, the special interest politicians, the government, the churches, the conservatives, the monarchists, the banks, Jewish financiers and communists, Freemasons, social democrats, liberals, reactionaries, and the army officer corps. He and his party members were under constant physical attack from the very well-organized Communist Party of Germany. At the beginning, all his meetings were violently disrupted and many of his supporters were killed or wounded. It was not until he was able to organize a security system of self-defense that people could feel free to listen to him without fear of being murdered or maimed. Despite the relentless attempts in curtailing his freedom of speech, Hitler persevered unafraid against all perpetrators of violence. The order was out: shut Hitler up at any cost. He survived and triumphed. It was unprecedented in history. Those who aspire to leadership do so with the backing and complicity from patrons or some other existing power structure. Hitler was opposed by every vested interest in the land. His only backing came from the people. While all the rich and powerful failed, Hitler succeeded. The answer lay in Hitler's amazing gift of organization and his unshakable belief that popular will must prevail. It took a remarkable man to bear with equanimity the odium and violence thrown at him by every section of the establishment. He kept his eyes to the goal he had set out to reach, forged ahead, and left his detractors and tormentors behind, fuming with rage and frustration, the lot of destructive and unproductive people. When the elections took place, Hitler had assembled the most powerful popular party Europe had ever known. On January 30, 1933, he would reach the Reichschancery in a strictly loyal way. By June 1933, Hitler was democratically given full executive power. In 1935, the Tsarland, which was under Allied control, where Hitler had been prevented from campaigning even though he had been chancellor for 2 years, voted overwhelmingly and democratically for Hitler. In Austria, Hitler's old political foes realized the public had spoken. Former socialist Chancellor Renner and Vienna's Cardinal Innitzer had urged the voters to back Anschluss, the reunion with Germany, just as Hitler had asked. Cardinal Innitzer had even signed his appeal with a large Heil Hitler. In the secrecy of the voting booth, people felt safe to give Hitler their votes. I have never seen such fervor and enthusiasm generated with such spontaneity. Countless flowers were deposited around busts of Hitler by thousands of people, who just wanted to show their appreciation. It has been an enduring and galling truth for Hitler's detractors to swallow: Germany had become Hitlerian by the wish of the people, as expressed at the ballot box. In 1919, Scheidemann had correctly predicted, "It is my firm conviction that the political future can only belong to those who will have opposed such demands of the Versailles Treaty by a categoric refusal." It was Hitler's destiny to reject and smash the iniquitous treaty. 21 years after the crushing of Germany, Hitler would arrive in Paris victorious. He had torn asunder the chains of bondage. On the first morning, he went to meditate at the tomb of Emperor Napoleon, whom he had painted on canvas in his youth. Napoleon had said, "Politics is destiny." As Hitler had swept away the Versailles Treaty, Bonaparte had on the 18th of Brumaire swept away the bloody French Revolution. I was in Paris at the time and was sharing a meal with my friend Otto Abetz, Germany's new ambassador to France. We were both scarcely more than 30 and pondered the eventual fate of the treaty. It had been found abandoned in a train during the panic flight of French politicians. The grand signatures of the victors of 1919, enhanced by scarlet wax, which were supposed to destroy Germany forever, were now without meaning. This famous treaty, which represented so much vengeance, greed and humiliation, had been left behind in the throes of a shameful debacle. It was there on my table, a historical curiosity. The treaty was well and truly dead. A page of human history had been turned. Whatever happened in the future, this volume would now be obsolete, never to be revived.